From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Martin Scorsese's new movie, Kundun, is about the young Dalai Lama. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear about the young Martin Scorsese. We feature an interview we recorded last February in which he talked about growing up in Manhattan's Little Italy. We also talked about his mother, Catherine, who until her recent death cooked for the cast of his films. She even appeared in several Scorsese films, including Mean Streets, Goodfellas, and Casino. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews pianist Leon Fleischer's first two-hand recording in three decades. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Kent Klein. An American telecommunications worker says he's planning to rest and spend time with his family after being allowed to return to the U.S. from Russia, where he stands accused of spying. From member station KPBS in San Diego, Scott Horsley reports.
Richard Bliss arrived home in San Diego to cheering family members and a giant Christmas card signed by hundreds of local well-wishers. Standing beneath a blue Welcome Home banner, Bliss thanked those who'd worked to win his release from Russian custody. While he still faces espionage charges, Bliss thinks it's a good sign he was allowed to come home.
Now that all the information's out in the open, my innocence has been established, I'm looking forward to the charges being dropped as soon as possible. Yes.
The 29-year-old field technician was installing a wireless phone system in Russia when he was picked up by security officers on suspicion of spying. He says he looks forward to returning to work and would not hesitate to accept another foreign assignment. For NPR News, I'm Scott Horsley in San Diego.
It was 1 year ago today that the body of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey was found in a house in Boulder, Colorado. A vigil is planned for tonight outside the house. A short vigil was held last night. One weeping teenager vowed that the girl's killer will be brought to justice. Two scientists at MIT say they've found a clue that may lead to a way to slow down the aging process. The researchers say aging may happen when circular bits of DNA build up within the nuclei of cells, clogging normal cellular machinery. The scientists did their study on brewer's yeast cells, but they say they believe the same process occurs in humans. Doctors have confirmed two more cases of the mysterious bird flu in Hong Kong. The virus was found in a 3-year-old girl who is in satisfactory condition and a 1-year-old boy who has recovered. 11 victims have been confirmed overall. 3 of them have died. The virus had infected only birds until this year. South Korea's highest court has upheld the prison term handed down to the wealthy chairman of the Hanbo Group. UPI's Jason Neely reports from Seoul.
South Korea's Supreme Court has upheld a 15-year prison term for a steel company founder charged with bribery and embezzlement. Chung Tae-soo bribed bankers and politicians to gain massive loans for Hanbo Iron and Steel, which collapsed in January under debts of almost $6 billion. A former Home Affairs minister, as well as top aides to President Kim Il-sung and President-elect Kim Dae-jung, were also sentenced to jail terms of up to 6 years. Hanbo was the first of 10 South Korean conglomerates hobbled by massive debts that have helped spark the country's recent currency crisis. Jason Neely, Seoul.
This will be the last season for the TV comedy Seinfeld. NBC has confirmed that the show will end production next spring. At noon on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 11.46 points at 7671.34 in light trading of 96 million shares. This is NPR News. Stocks opened higher on Wall Street today following a rebound in South Korea's financial markets. At noon, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 11.46 points at 7671.34. More from Bloomberg's Paul Ehrlich in New York.
Stocks rose on the heels of a 7% rebound in South Korea's market overnight. That came after the International Monetary Fund and Group of Seven Nations pledged $10 billion in speeded-up aid to South Korea. That action reassured U.S. investors. But the market closes in about an hour today, and many traders and investors are taking the day off. So the trend is hard to determine. Bond prices are little changed. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite Index are narrowly ahead. I'm Paul Ehrlich.
Many stores are offering deep discounts today in hopes of making up for disappointing holiday sales. From big retailers like Sears and Macy's to small shops, merchants opened early and cut prices to get shoppers in the buying mood. A Walmart in West Virginia opened at 6 o'clock this morning and had lines outside its door. Despite a booming economy and high consumer confidence, the holidays failed to meet many retailers' expectations. Shoppers returning their holiday gifts may find they don't get full refunds. A number of companies have put together tougher return laws this year. Circuit City is joining some other electronics chains in charging a 15% restocking fee for merchandise that's been opened. Citicorp is denying reports it's talking with South Korean bank officials about buying a stake in Korea First Bank or Seoul Bank. There's no immediate comment from Chase Manhattan. There's reports that Citibank and Chase Manhattan are interested. I'm Kent Klein, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese's new film, Kundun, is about the young Dalai Lama. On this archive edition, we'll hear about the young Martin Scorsese, his childhood, and his family. Martin Scorsese has his pick of actors and actresses, but for the role of an older mother, he often cast his own mother, Catherine Scorsese. One of his early films was a documentary about his mother and father called Italian American.
Well, you were going to tell us about the sauce. You were going to show us how to do the sauce.
Well, what should I say?
Well, you're going to get up and show it to us, but I wanted to know who, you know, how did you learn it?
Well, what are you asking?
About the sauce. How did you learn how to make sauce?
Well, I'm supposed to be talking to you.
You could talk to me, yes. You could talk to them. It doesn't matter. I'll be over here.
Should I mention your name?
No. Doesn't matter. Yeah, you mentioned my name, yeah.
What should I say? How did you learn
how to make sauce?
Why don't you ask me the question? Don't you hear that then?
No.
I mean, if you would ask me a question, I would answer.
I'm gonna say it now.
Right?
I want to know how you learned how to make sauce. Who taught it to you? How many years you've been doing it, and I want to see you do it.
Well, you know, when you first get married, you're really not much of a cook. I watched my mother make sauce. I watched my mother-in-law. I got a lot from my mother-in-law, a lot from the family.
She got more than my mother, from my mother.
See, there he goes putting his mother in again.
All right, let's go inside and see.
So now, if you want me to show you, I'll come and show you how I make the sauce.
There were two different cooks anyway, to begin
with. How am I doing so far?
Terrific.
All right, now.
It's hard to tell who's directing who in that scene. As for the sauce recipe, it was published last year in Catherine Scorsese's book, Italian American, the Scorsese Family Cookbook. It was her last project before her death 1 year ago at the age of 84. Last February, we invited Martin Scorsese to share some of his memories of his mother, her cooking, her acting, and their family life when he was growing up in New York's Little Italy. We reached him by phone at his office, where he was editing his film, Kundun. What was special about your mother's cooking?
Well, the thing, I guess the element, I mean, the thing I always think of with my mother is the food, in terms of showing her love for the children. You know, was constantly giving food and constantly making sure the sustenance was there. This was pretty much what she was able to do throughout my whole life. And then, you know, even as we got older, she would still deliver food to the house and that sort of thing, or whichever house I was living in at the time, or the New York or L.A. I recall one time giving some... one of her recipes of chicken, which was made with a lemon and a garlic sauce, that I think Francis Coppola took back with him to San Francisco on a plane. So she was constantly, I think, showing her appreciation and love for people by feeding them.
Now, I know your mother cooked for some of your films. Was her cooking for the on-screen food or for the meals for the actors or both?
I think it was both, really. I think... very often it was food for the actors off camera, and when she would show up on the set, and then particularly Goodfellas, certain scenes she cooked for, and I'm trying to think of how many. There were several scenes in the film which there was food, and particularly the one with Joe Pesci and De Niro after killing the fellow in the bar.
Well, in fact, there's a still from that scene on the cover of your mother's book, Italian American.
Yes.
It's a great scene. I mean, in Goodfellas, your mother played Joe Pesci's mother. And
right.
in the scene that we're talking about, he and some of the boys are having dinner at his mother's house. And what she doesn't know is that they've just beaten up a guy, and he's sitting in the trunk of their car, which is parked just outside her house.
Well, they have to dispose of the body. They think he's dead, but he isn't. They don't know that yet. And they stop off to get some food. Well, first they stop off to get a shovel to bury him. So while they were there, the mother woke up and she fed them, not knowing, of course, what's going on. And but the thing about it is that it's interesting in that it's a mother's love for her son. She doesn't, you know, she would never believe any of the stories about him, and she's just glad to have him home, even if it's in the middle of the night, and along with his friends, whom she treats as if they were her sons, you know.
Now, what did you tell your mother about this scene? How much did she know about what was really happening in the larger movie?
Oh, I wouldn't tell her that there was a body in the trunk. No, I just said, you know, your son's come home, and you haven't seen him in 2 or 3 days. He tells you he's working, you know, but you have no proof of that, but still you believe him. Why should he lie? And you have, you want to make sure the first thing when he comes home, you want to make sure, even if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, has he had anything to eat? And especially if he has friends, you might as well feed them something.
Let's hear an excerpt of the scene.
So tell me, where have you been? I haven't seen you. You haven't even called or anything. Where have you been?
Well, Mom, I've been working nights.
And?
Well, tonight we were out late. We took a ride out to the country, and we hit one of those deers. That's where the blood came from. I told you. Jimmy told you before. I won't change. Anyway, you know, reminds me, I need this knife. I'm going to take this. It's okay?
Okay, yeah.
I just need it for
bring
a little
it back,
while.
Though, you know.
Well, the poor thing, you know, I hit him in his, we hit the deer in his paw, what do you call it?
The hoof
got caught in the grill.
Oh.
I gotta hack it off.
Ooh.
Ma, it's a sin, you gotta leave it there, you know, so. Anyway, I'll bring your knife back if they do that.
Anyway.
Delicious.
Thank you. Why don't you get yourself a nice girl?
I get a nice one almost every night, Ma.
Yeah, but get yourself a girl so you could settle down. That's what I
settle down almost every night, but then in the morning I'm free. I love you. I want to be with you.
Why don't you settle down?
So what did she think of the actual movie when she saw the whole thing play out?
Well, she was surprised. She felt a trick had been played on her, but it was perfect for the film, you know.
Now, you used your mother as an actress in several of your films. You use her voice in King of Comedy, a great film about a loser named Rupert Pupkin who fancies himself a brilliant comic in need of a big break. And he spends his time sitting alone in his basement imagining
right.
that he's on late-night TV schmoozing with the stars.
Right.
And in this scene, Pupkin, played by De Niro, is in the basement, and his mother, played by your mother, is yelling down to him to come upstairs. Let's hear it.
And now, from New York, it's the Jerry Langford Show with Jerry's guests, Richard Pryor, Ben Gazzara, Elizabeth Ashley, Carol Burnett,
and the comedy find of the year, making his television debut, Rupert Pupkin, the new
Rupert.
King of comedy.
Rupert,
and
are
now,
you crazy?
Say
what's
hello
the matter
to
with you?
Jerry.
Ah, Mom.
You fell asleep. Lower it.
Oh.
What's the matter with you?
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Now, what did you tell her about this scene, and how did you decide to use her as De Niro's mother?
Well, that's a good example of the kind of works that she did. She was so open and free, you know. It's interesting because I just said that Bob's character, he was still living with his mother. But in order to have some freedom, she gave him the basement to use as his own. And very much the same way, I think he was living in Union City, New Jersey. But the mother never went down to the basement. It was his own private domain. But at his age, he should have been out of the house, but he's still living in the house. So that he carries on his fantasy life in that basement. And she hears audio tapes, she hears him talking, she hears him doing monologues. And there's a constant running monologue with his mother that he has throughout all this because he's making too much noise in the basement. She's wondering what he's doing.
Now, did your other mother ever worry or wonder about you? Were you up to strange things, imagining movies or making movies?
considering the house set up in King of Comedy where a person had a basement to himself, that was like a luxury. We had like 3.5 rooms in the Lower East Side. on Elizabeth Street, in which my mother, my father, myself, and my elder brother lived all together, so that the only time I had for myself was between 3:30 and 5 o'clock after grammar school, in which I would come home and spend some time myself, do my homework, and do my own drawings and that sort of thing. So everything else had to be done kind of, I don't know, the drawings I was doing and stuff like that were done as much as possible in a very small room that I was sharing with my brother.
No privacy at all, huh?
None, no. Not at all.
So did your mother interrupt your fantasy life?
Yes, I think they all did. I mean, you know, the way of life downtown was a very open public thing. You know, the windows were open. You could see into the next apartments. Your door in the summertime particularly was open in the hall, in which you could see right down the hall, a few steps down the hall, the other person, the other family living across the way, their door was open. So everybody would, you know, you'd share food or you'd have coffee together. It was a very open world that we were in, especially, as I say, in the summertime or in the spring. And the winter was kind of cold, very little heat. And we would have, it still was not a public situation. I mean, it still was not a private, it still wasn't private enough, you know. I even recall sleeping on the fire escapes in the summer. There were no fans and certainly no air conditioning. And so we found the privacy somehow, you know. We found the time to do what I wanted to do somehow. But there was always the constant interruption of daily life.
My guest is Martin Scorsese. His new movie, Kundun, is about the young Dalai Lama. More with Martin Scorsese after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Martin Scorsese, recorded last February. The back of your mother's cookbook has a list of all the roles that she had in your films and in other people's films as well, including scenes that ended up on the cutting room floor. And you apparently cast her in a small role in Taxi Driver, but that scene never made it into the film. What was the scene? I'd love to hear about it.
Oh, it was just a very small scene in which it was his first fare, and basically consisted of her trying to get in the back of the cab with two big shopping bags. You know, and it just didn't, I mean, we didn't need it, actually, so we took it out of the picture. But she was in Mean Streets. She was in a lot of the films. I think a lot of the bigger, the more interesting things were, for example, her in King of Comedy, where she treated, it was really interesting because we just needed the woman to be a mother, you know. And it didn't matter that it was Robert De Niro that she was improvising with. She was given the premise. Her son is in the basement. That's his room. He's making noise. She has to go to sleep. And what is she going to tell him? And she just went on. It didn't matter that it was De Niro. It didn't matter that it's making a movie. She just took the reality of it and treated him like a child, which was very funny, actually. And you can see in some of the scenes, he's starting to laugh. We had to cut around it, actually, because he was starting to laugh, not meaning to laugh, but his shoulders were shaking a few times and laughing, because it didn't matter who he was. She was just going to tell him what she had to tell him.
So you didn't write the lines for your mother?
No,
you just
not at all.
Improvised?
That was totally improvised.
The impression I get from the documentary that you made about your parents, Italian-American, is that she was a really good talker.
Yeah. You see, the thing about her is her and my father, I learned about storytelling, I think. She had a way of telling stories with a great sense of humor and good timing. And my father had another sense of storytelling, which was more somber and more dealing with the moral aspect of the story. But she had more of had the humor and the human touch in another way, and they sort of complemented each other very well, very well in the storytelling. And I guess that's what I grew up with. That combined with seeing lots of movies and films in the theaters and on television, because as I said, they were working class people and they never had much of an education, barely made it through grammar school, and didn't really read. My father read the newspaper, the Daily News, the Daily Mirror, and my mother didn't read. You know, I mean, they could read, but they didn't read books. So there were no books in the house until I started to go to high school.
You cast your father in some roles in your films as well.
Yes.
How did you first start casting your parents? Was it an effort to just save money on extras, or did you see something in them that you thought would really work on screen?
Well, what was really interesting I learned it when I did the documentary on them, Italian American, where I learned about their storytelling, and it crystallized it for me and made me able to make a picture like Raging Bull a few years down the line. And because of that, because I thought of the honesty and the truthful way in which they talked, which they spoke, I wanted to go for the real thing in the movies. So, particularly in Raging Bull, I wanted my father in that because of the nature of the people in the film and the world that he came from and that he knew. And it's just his movement, just his presence feels right for me and would equalize everyone else in the scenes with him. You know, the other people played by Nick Colasanto, who played Tommy Como, Frank Vincent, Frank Adonis, all these other people who were in the scenes with him, it all blended right. It looked right. It looked like Nick Colasanto's cousin, whom he had to have around all the time, was a very close friend of his, was sort of a counselor in a way. And men that you always see in these situations together, you never quite know who does what. That's kind of the world that I grew up in, and it made it seem very comfortable and very real to me, rather than having actors do it.
Did your parents disapprove of anything in your films or try to parent you while they were on your set?
Well, I think Mean Streets, when it was shown at the New York Film Festival, was a pretty grueling experience. My mother and father and myself, I was sitting in a different part of the auditorium, but Alice Tully Hall, it was the first real public presentation of a film of mine, and it was kind of the acid test in a way, and we were all sitting there, and it was excruciating. And the film was received fairly well. There was some boos in the audience, too, some people booing us, which was interesting. Kind of balanced out. I thought it was kind of nice. And so I preferred the applause, of course, but still, that kind of had an... Because the film was... I didn't think it was a film that was going to be shown very much. It was a film I sort of had to make, and I was just glad to have gotten the money to make it. I didn't even think it was going to be shown in the New York Film Festival. It was a dream of mine, but it had come true. But I didn't really... I didn't anticipate much more beyond that. And so as the people filed out of the auditorium, my mother and father came out, and they were kind of shaken a little bit. And my father said first, "I'll never go through that again." You know, I know, me too. Never again. And my mother, when people went up to her and said, "What do you think of the film? You know, what did you think of your son's the reaction to your son's film?" She says, "I just want you to understand one thing: we never use that language in the house." And that's all she kept telling people.
Did she not want your relatives, your aunts and uncles, to see it?
Well, yeah, she wanted to see it, but they were very concerned about the language. But the street language, certainly was not used in the house. I can tell you that because it would have been an insult to use that language in front of your mother in the house and that sort of thing. And so it was a very delicate issue about that language. But that language was used in the street, and I wanted to be as truthful as possible. And I think it was the first film to use that language in total throughout the picture anyway. In any event, I was told by her, why does it have to be such dirty language? So, particularly in Goodfellas, too, a little bit. But they enjoyed Goodfellas. They liked the humor of it. And so, finally, in Casino, I had her play a scene. I had her play a scene in which she could comment on the language.
You know, a lot of young people, young artists, would go to extremes to keep their parents off the set or away from their work. Because when you're young and you're starting to establish yourself, you're sometimes struggling to become a person that may be very different than the person your parents believe you to be or want you to be. So it can be very problematic to have them around. Did this never bother you?
I think around the time I was doing Taxi Driver in New York, New York, around 76 and 77, those 2 years. But, you know, the reality was after New York, New York particularly, I had gone a certain distance in the work I was doing, and I had to pull myself back together to try to figure out what kind of films I wanted to make or how I could survive in the system, because I wasn't too happy making films for other people in a way. I wanted to make my own films, and I was looking again for my own, I guess, something. Did I have anything more to say besides what I said in Mean Streets, you say?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even say Taxi Driver, because Taxi Driver really comes from Paul Schrader, although I agreed and felt passionate about what he had to say in that. And I fought to the end to get that film as uncompromised as it is today on screen, I hope, anyway. I still couldn't, I didn't know what else I had in me, you see. And ultimately, after going through a difficult period in 76 and 77 into 78, after I came out of that and somehow it was formulated into Raging Bull, which is a project that De Niro initiated, not me, I sort of found myself in that character and in that milieu. And at that point, I realized there's no sense in running away from what I am. I might as well just embrace it and put it up there on the screen. That's who I come from, these people.
But your mother was in your student films and in Mean Streets.
That was basically to help us out.
Uh-huh.
That we needed cast at that point. She had to be there.
But it was never like an embarrassment for you to have mom on the set.
No, she had a good sense of humor. You see, she had a very good sense of humor, and she actually played along with us. She did what we wanted, which was good. It was difficult in Mean Streets one night in that scene in the hallway, because in the hallway we were shooting on Mulberry Street, and the lights, we blew the lights, and the people in the building had to go to work the next day, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's at one point I had to tell her, she was complaining. She says, you've got a close-up, you've got a wide shot, and she was talking like a producer.
This is the scene when Harvey Keitel's girlfriend has an epileptic seizure.
Yeah, when he's fighting with De Niro in the hallway, and it's one of the key scenes in the film. It was only the fourth or fifth day of shooting, too, and at one point I had to tell her, keep quiet and get in the corner. And she got offended, but she did it. You know, as mom, it was like she saw there was life or death at that point in that hallway for all the actors. You know, we had to get it on film, and we had to get the raw emotion on film. You know, that was the problem. So from that point on, it kind of changed.
Martin Scorsese recorded last February. His new film Kundun has just been released. Here's music from the soundtrack composed by Philip Glass.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Martin Scorsese. We'll find out why he hired his father to be a consultant for Goodfellas. And Lord Schwartz reviews pianist Leon Fleischer's first two-hand recording in three decades. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Martin Scorsese, recorded last February while he was editing his film Kundun, which has just opened. Our interview was recorded about a month after the death of Scorsese's mother, Catherine. Her final project was her Scorsese family cookbook called Italian American. She often cooked for the actors on the sets of Martin Scorsese's films, and she played the role of a mother in several of his films, including Goodfellas, King of Comedy, and Casino. Now, I'm wondering if you saw your mother differently after making her into almost a mythical mother by using her as the mother in your movies.
That's interesting. Not really. What I appreciated was that a lot of other people appreciated her.
Yeah.
That was kind of nice. And as I said, I mean, there's nothing. This is what I come from, and this is who I am. And I'm not a Hollywood director of the teens and 20s who invented the form and who rode horses like John Ford and Raoul Walsh and all the people I admired. I'm just not. You know, I come from the Lower East Side, asthmatic kid. Interested in the church. I was interested in movies. The family gave me a background in storytelling. And basically, if I run away from that, I'm running away from myself, so I might as well put it in the movies.
It's funny you should mention that you didn't ride horses, because my favorite photograph in your mother's cookbook is a picture of you and your parents when you're a child. You look like you're maybe 6 or 7, and you're dressed up in a Western outfit that all of us who grew up in the 1950s remember, with the Western hat, and you have a little holster around.
Well, that was one of my favorites, Hopalong Cassidy. That was he wore black and white, so he had a good sense of style, Hopalong. William Boyd played that part, and I kind of like Hopalong Cassidy. He was great in black and white. He wore black with white fringe sometimes, I think it was, I'm not quite sure, but a white horse. Although I also liked Roy Rogers a great deal in Gene Autry, I must say.
So did you hope to one day grow up to be a cowboy?
Oh, I thought that was about the age of 4 or 5. I thought that was wonderful. You see, because I was always kept in the house, and the only way I had a sense of outdoors were the Western movies that they took me to see in these old Technicolor process. Sometimes they were in a two-color process, which was more magical than the three-color process. It only showed blue and orange in a way, or blue and pale yellow. And the horses, the coat on the horses was so beautiful in this cine color, or this true color, they called it, in different forms. Different studios had different ways of using it. And that was my only way to get a sense of the outdoors and a sense of fantasy, was to see these Westerns, and I just thought it was terrific. But, of course, I wasn't allowed to see any animals or go near any animals because I was asthmatic.
Oh, of course.
And allergic to everything. So I couldn't go near a tree or grass or horses or dogs or cats or anything like that. So, you know, it was a bit, it represented a fantasy for me. And that's why I guess I loved that that cowboy outfit.
Oh, that's
when
great.
I was a kid.
Yeah. Now, your father, in your mother's cookbook, your father is described as a consultant on Goodfellas and Raging Bull. How did you use him as a consultant?
Oh, again, the detail. The way they played, for example, there's a scene where they're playing cards in a social club, which begins, it's just a cutaway.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem important, but it's a cutaway. The scene begins with it. And then you hear people talking, and then you go into the major scene, which is Nicola Santo and Frank Vincent and I think Joe Pesci talking at a table, trying to settle a problem that occurred or whatever. And they're playing cards in the background. But before the dialogue started, you saw a shot of the men playing cards. One of them is my father. The card game had to be accurate. It couldn't be pinochle. It couldn't be poker. It had to be... I forget the name of the game. I forget what they called it in Italian, but an old Sicilian card game that people played in the old days, that sort of thing. The look of certain props, he could tell if certain things were not accurate. And also a 16-millimeter footage in color that we shot of a wedding reception on a roof. In the middle of the whole movie section of Raging Bull, for example, was based on the wedding reception of my mother and father, who were married in June of 1933, and it was so hot that they all went up to the roof of their apartment tenement. And so I wanted it pretty much like what they had. And immediately he saw them bring on a silver coffee urn. And he said they would never have that. It's just too poor to have that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was that sort of thing. And, with some observations that I knew, but basically making sure that the prop man and that... actors looked a certain way, or he would let me know if he felt somebody really didn't look right, and that sort of thing. And, we, you know, basically details of cultural details is what we were talking about.
Did your father have any dealings with the neighborhood wise guys?
Well, it's a matter of not having dealings with it. If you know, you grow up in an area and the whole area is permeated with that, you have to live with them in a way. Doesn't mean you're one of them, but it's like living, I don't know, like living in Hollywood, you know, or living in Washington and saying, you're on a certain level and you deal with these people, but you're not one of them. What can you do?
Right.
You have to survive. You don't have the advantages and the tools to get out of there because you don't have the education.
Did he warn you away from certain people?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, be very careful. But on the other hand, it was a matter of respecting certain people, too. You couldn't show disrespect to these people. And it was a matter of sharing, you know, what he learned, which was how to survive there without really being one of them in a way, you know. It's a very complex situation, but especially in the old days, because I think a lot of those people took the place of government authority, church authority. They deal with them over family matters, you know, to settle family disputes. I mean, I'm not painting an apologia for the situation, but that's what, you know, you come from. They come from, well, on Elizabeth Street and Prince and Mott and Houston and Mulberry. A lot of these people came over. My grandparents came over from Sicily, and they brought with them the Sicilian village, you see. And so people living on Elizabeth Street mainly came from Sicily, and each building almost represented a different village or a different town in Sicily. 232 Elizabeth Street, I recall, where my mother was born, I think reflected Cimina, the village that the city that they came from, the town they came from in Sicily, my mother's father and my mother's mother. Across the way, 241, represented Polizzi Generosa, a town that my father's father came from. And so, in a way, they took the way of life of the village to America and to that particular street, which did not deal with the police force and did not deal with politicians in the American sense. It dealt with village elders in a way, and the village elders may have been, I don't know this for sure, but may have been old-fashioned mafia members.
Yeah, your parents basically grew up across the street from each other,
yeah.
and they brought you up just down the street from where they grew up.
Right, at 253 Elizabeth, yeah.
Did they live in Little Italy all their lives?
Well, they lived there until they got married in 33, moved to Sunnyside, I think, Queens, and then in 1949, had to move back to Elizabeth Street. And I was 6 or 7, I was 7 years old or 8 years old, for some difficulty that was in Queens for some reason, landlord problems and that sort of thing. And we had to move back, and we stayed at my grandmother's at 241 for about 6 months until we got rooms, 3.5 rooms on down the block at 253.
Did your parents ever move out of there?
Well, after about, after about 20 years ago, in the mid-60s, they moved across the street to an apartment in a renovated building, and it was on the second floor. A little easier for them to climb up. Of course, in the old one, we were on the third floor, and the stairs were kind of difficult. They were very steep in that particular building. But then about 1977, they were getting too old to walk up the steps. So I got them into an apartment building on 3rd Avenue between 18th and 19th Street. And they lived on the 20th floor, and they lived there until they died.
So they never wanted to move out to the suburbs?
Oh, no, never. The biggest joy that they had, the enjoyment that they had, was going to shop in the Lower East Side.
Right.
And going to see all their friends who were running the markets and the butcher shop and that sort of thing. And the cheese shop, DiPaolo on Grand Street, I think it is. And Mary Albanese, who's 92 years old, who's still cutting meat on Elizabeth Street, 240, I think, Elizabeth Street. She's still there.
There's a picture of her in your mother's book.
Right, yeah. So they would go and keep the tradition going that way.
My guest is Martin Scorsese. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Martin Scorsese, recorded last February while he was editing his film Kundun, which has just been released. You know, Mean Streets is about someone who's trying to get out of Little Italy, the neighborhood you grew up in, but all the personal ties and responsibilities are conspiring against him actually leaving. Was that a fear of yours, that you wouldn't get out?
It's interesting. I mean, for me, it's a matter of getting out. It was rather difficult because, you know, I don't have any... I don't know how to say. In a sense, it's like being in a small village or a small town in America, and you want to go to the big city. You see, it was like we were almost cut off from America in that area, in a way. We had our own way of thinking and our own social situations. There was no other way for me to... I didn't know what I could do down there. What could I do if I stayed there? What would I do? Work in a restaurant, open a restaurant. What would I do? I mean, I found myself getting involved in education, going to school, and kept going to school. I was involved with the first thing that came to mind was the priesthood, because that seemed like the only viable route to not do what everyone else was doing down there. Not everyone else, but what everyone was stuck down there. I wasn't going to be a greengrocer. I wasn't going to be a butcher. I just was not that kind of person. We had more opportunities open for us through education. And so where was I to go? And so I thought first mainly of the church. And then as I went through high school and to the university, New York University in the West Side, that's when things began to change, and I began to take it to feel that maybe, just maybe, because of the way films were being made in the late 50s, early 60s in America, more independent cinema was being made. The New American Underground was flourishing with Jonas Mekas as the sort of high priest, and it was very exciting. Of course, I wasn't a bohemian, so I didn't understand those films, but I just saw what they were doing with film, which was so fascinating. And then, of course, you know, John Cassavetes was making films in the streets with a small camera, you see. Now, that was interesting to me, and that was a possibility.
Did your parents encourage you to continue with film, or did they think that you were thinking too big and that you'd only be hurt and you were being utterly impractical?
Well, I remember a doctor came to the wake recently, my mother's wake, and he says, I remember they used to tell one of their doctors, he says, I remember the stories they would tell me about you and when you were in school, and they thought you were crazy. They'd say to each other, I think he's really insane.
Did you know that?
No. They said, but, and they continued talking, he's crazy. He said, but in the meantime, some people have given some awards. So he must be good. I don't know. He must be good. I guess we should try to support it, you know. My father always said always have a backup with, in business or in teaching, because he was worried that of course, it was unheard of that anybody from where we were would go into filmmaking. But, you know, filmmaking at that time meant to them and to me, too, to a certain extent, the tradition of the great studio tradition of Hollywood, the old Hollywood that I really admire and love, which has gone and died in the late 50s, early 60s.
Well, so when your mother was in your movie, she must have thought, well, this isn't really a movie. This is just something
my son is doing, yeah. It's my son. So, you know, we made it open and free that way.
You know, I was just watching again your documentary about your parents, Italian American, which is on video, and I'm thinking what a wonderful document that must be for you to have of your parents now that they're both gone.
Yeah, you know, I was very interesting. That was very interesting to find, as I asked one or two questions, all this came out, all these stories came out, and because it was the only thing that was scripted were the questions. I didn't know what they were going to say, and so it was really interesting to me, and. I found the combination of that dialogue, the way one would say one thing and the other would answer, or they'd almost speak in stereo, commenting and correcting each other and overlapping dialogue. And I found the sense of humor and the freedom really interesting, and I learned a lot about storytelling again, that it doesn't really matter ultimately. I mean, it matters to a certain extent, of course, but What's most important in images and films are it's like the human face, you see, and if the person is expressive enough and has something interesting to say or something, if the emotion is right, that's all you need is a shot of the face, and that's why the technique in that particular documentary is consciously primitive jump cuts, cut to black leader in between stories, or that sort of thing, right? It made no attempt. I made very, very little attempt, I think, anyway, as I recall, to try to make it very smooth and polished.
I want to let you get back to work.
I have to go, yes.
Yeah, but tell me what we're interrupting. What are you doing today?
We've just begun editing a film called Kundun, which is a story of the young Dalai Lama from the age of 2 years old to 18 years old. And it's told from his point of view, and it's a story about really a man who has to, a boy who becomes a man and has to deal with the terrible political problems of his reign as Dalai Lama, with the communist government of China coming into the country and trying to, well, basically changing everything, and of course putting an end to the religion and that sort of thing. And of course, as you know, it's a theocracy, and cutting off the culture of the Tibetans, which is really frightening. But in any event, it takes that story up to the point at which he has to escape and go to the West.
Just one question about this movie. This is the movie that the Chinese government tried to convince Disney not to distribute because it doesn't make the Chinese look very good. So what was it like for you to be in the middle of this dispute between China and Disney? It's like a new version of the Cold War.
I know, it's kind of odd, but we were just shooting away in Morocco, and thankfully none of it really hit us. Disney was very people at Disney were very supportive. In fact, they didn't even really let us know until it went public. I think in October, it went public, but the Chinese came out in the Financial Times in London, got a hold of it, and complained about it. But they show their support. Disney showed their support, and as you can see, it's not a film that it's an intimate film, and it's a film about the question of nonviolence, how one could sustain a life and a culture and do the right thing by being nonviolent when you have one ideology being attacked by another ideology, which is communism, one religion against another religion, in a sense. And one of them is a nonviolent religion. And so the dilemma is really, I think, at the very core of all of our existences today. To take the violent road is annihilation of humanity. To go the nonviolent route, something may happen. And that's where the interest lies for me in the picture. The Chinese are going to be, I guess they're going to be very concerned about it and very upset about it. But when you see the film, I think you'll understand it's not a propaganda film, the type of films that were made in World War II here in America. It's, as I said again, a very intimate story and done as honestly as possible.
Well, let me let you get back to your movie. I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for sharing some wonderful stories about your mother. Thank you very
thank
much.
You. Thanks a lot.
Martin Scorsese recorded last February. His new film, Kundun, has just been released. Coming up, pianist Leon Fleischer's first two-hand recording in three decades. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Leon Fleischer has been in the news lately since he resigned his post as artistic director of the Tanglewood Music Center. But there's other news, at least as important, according to music critic Lloyd Schwartz. Fleischer has just released his first two-hand recording in three decades. He suffers from repetitive stress syndrome, which has forced him to play only with his left hand. Lloyd says the repertoire chosen for this new recording isn't what you'd usually pick to feature a pianist.
For the first recording in 35 years on which pianist Leon Fleischer uses both his hands, you might have expected at least a concerto or a sonata, some work that gives primary importance to the soloist. But Fleischer has always been an unusual musician, and his new recording on Arabesque consists of three song cycles. No, Fleischer doesn't sing. The vocalizing is left to two well-known hyphenated vocalists, soprano Phyllis Brynjolfsson and baritone John Shirley Quirk, neither of them in the full flush of youthful freshness. They sing the words to Schumann's Opus 24 Liederkreis, which is the generic German word for a collection of songs, Frauenliebe und Leben, a woman's love and life, and the heart-stopping Dichterliebe, a poet's love, Schumann's setting of 16 short poems by Heinrich Heine. But it's Fleischer who supplies most of the poetry. These cycles, especially the Dichterliebe, contain some of Schumann's very greatest writing for the piano. The accompaniment is not just there to give the singers breathing space or to tell them what key to sing in. It's a kind of running commentary on the poems, expanding their expression or undercutting them with irony. There are also exquisite and evocative preludes to the songs and extraordinary postludes, like the last chapters of 19th century Russian novels that tell us what happens to the characters after the story is officially over. Here's the very end of Dichterliebe. Heine's poems have traced the misery of a failed relationship, but Schumann's postlude has something not in the words themselves. A mysterious backward glance from the transcendent world of art, where the poet, singer, composer has finally found his resting place. It's over a minute and a half of just piano, and Fleischer gives this music the most sensitive and mysterious reading imaginable. Perhaps in celebration of Fleischer's triumphant return to the central two-hand repertoire, Sony has reissued a set of Fleischer's Brahms recordings from the old and never more appropriately named Epic label. There are the two piano concertos with George Sell and the Cleveland Orchestra, and Fleischer's marvelous performances of the Brahms Handel variations and the irresistible Opus 39 waltzes. Thank you. These old recordings, made between 1956 and 1962, are as fresh as ever. Fleischer is both powerful and scintillating without ever sounding fussy or overblown. He plays with the startling notion that you can convey energy and passion with clarity and tact. And the heartening news is that on his brand new recording, he's lost none of these qualities.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Leon Fleischer's new recording of Schumann's Song Cycles on the Arabesque label and the new reissue of Fleischer Historic Brahms recordings in Sony's Masterworks Heritage series. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a three-day tribute to Frank Sinatra. We'll talk with Will Friedwald, author of Sinatra, The Song Is You, and we'll play lots of great Sinatra records. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Let's fly away. Come fly with me. Let's float down to Peru.